Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio in real time via ZipWhip landline texting at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Memorial Day right around the corner, and we're going to talk about Memorial Day and history stuff this morning. John Hennessy back, the chief historian with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park, and we might as well say it straight off at the beginning, and a Pittsburgh Penguins fan.
Well,
good morning.
It occurred to me this morning that you have lived almost one-sixth of your life since the Red Wings won the Stanley Cup, and I'm very proud to say that the Penguins ended that run, crushed their spirit, and crushed yours as well, because you've really, honestly, never been the same.
No, I haven't. That Game 7 on that Friday night in Detroit, I was so certain they were going to win.
Right.
And
you know, it does pain me to remind you of it constantly. So I try to go easy on that. But
and the fact that the Red Wings weren't even in the playoffs this year has made it a very long spring.
One-sixth of your life since they were there. So.
Thank you for sitting down and figuring that
out.
I'm good at math. Anyway, moving on to other things. This is Memorial Day weekend. Councilman Matt Kelly was in last week, and we were talking, and you and I have had the same talk about Memorial Day around here. Just has a different there's a different feeling toward Memorial Day around here, just because of what this community has gone through.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly an ancient tradition here. Of all the towns of the South, I think Fredericksburg probably has one of the longest continuous records of observing Memorial Day, starting in 1871 with services at the National Cemetery, which were organized by and large by the African American community at that time and would be for the next dozen years or more. But I think obviously the personal connection of a community that was wrapped in struggle during the war, that had to cope with literally tens of thousands of dead left in its backyards and gardens and farm lots. And of course, you know, in the Confederate cemetery on Amelia Street, those dead often being, you know, men, boys of the community.
Yeah.
So it's something that this community has always taken to heart. It's never really been huge in terms of the scale of events, but it has been rhythmic and diligent and heartfelt, both at the National Cemetery up on Willis Hill and at the Confederate Cemetery. And in fact, until a few years ago, the ceremony at the Confederate Cemetery used to be at 10 o'clock and we would be at 11 o'clock. And people struggled to get to both. So our ceremony on Memorial Day itself is now at noon to allow people to move between the two programs if they wish to do that.
And it was a few years ago that the noon ceremony was preceded. It's preceded now by a procession that's very moving to see.
Yeah, the story of that. I think this is the sixth or seventh year that the procession will do its thing. It starts at what is Riverfront Park today, next to Shiloh Old Site Baptist Church. And what it does is recalls a period immediately after the war when the observances at the cemetery were led and organized by the African American community. And they would gather at the downtown churches, notably Shiloh Old Site, and then march. Through the streets of Fredericksburg, out to the Sunken Road, and then hold their ceremonies there. Of course, at that time, there was the community was still very much stung by war. The presence of a national cemetery in the midst of a community that had been so badly beaten and battered and suffered so much was not something that was universally acclaimed, certainly by the white population here. And so several years ago, the local members of the 23rd United States Colored Troops decided to organize this just little procession to recall that tradition back then. And it really is. I've tagged along at the end of it, and anyone's welcome to come. They form at they leave at 11 o'clock from Shiloh Old Site Baptist Church on Sophia Street, 801 Sophia Street in the Riverfront Park there. And it is a very, you know, there are acts that we do that sometimes that we'll remember for a long time. And I think people who have done that walk through town with the 23rd USCT, they will remember having done it.
Just the history behind it, yes, and what it represents.
Right.
And just how meaningful it was back the first time it was done.
Well, and, you know, what it really highlights, though, is the degree to which the African-American community here over the decades since the mid-1880s when the tradition faded away has become separated from the legacy of the Civil War, and specifically the emancipationist legacy of the war. You know, we went through many, 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 many decades where generally Americans didn't necessarily see the war as a war of freedom or a war of emancipation. And if they did, they didn't necessarily cheer that. But we're in a different age now, I think. And, you know, so this is that this event, this procession is really a reconnection to that component of the war. Because for, you know, once Memorial Day exercises began in Fredericksburg in the late 1860s, up until the mid-1880s, they were organized dominantly by the African-American community as a celebration of freedom. And it was only when, in 1884, first Union veterans asked to participate, and as a gesture of reconciliation, they requested that Confederate veterans be included in the ceremonies. And it's a little bit of a hard story, but the Confederate veterans responded by saying, yes, we're happy to participate as long as the African-American people do not. And that was the beginning of the end of that tradition. And it's a very vivid event where, you know, the desire for reconciliation between the sections, North and South, trumped for many, many years the that celebration of the war as a moment of freedom for African Americans. And so that tradition was lost, and it was really only until, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, it remained disconnected. And one of the great challenges that we have is helping people to understand the entire breadth of the impact of the Civil War, the legacy of the Civil War. It's constitutional. You know, you have three major amendments come out of the war. It is political in that, you know, there was definitely a departure point for a movement toward a more centralized, stronger federal government. You know, that's an issue we've been arguing about in this country since the nation was formed,
yeah,
and argue about today as well. But there's no questioning that it was a departure point for that. It was the emancipation, the end of slavery, was really in many ways the albatross lifted off the nation that allowed it to stride onto the world stage as a world power. Because I think even most Americans realized by the 1860s that was not going to happen as long as the nation was a slave nation. Certainly Lincoln realized that.
Yeah.
And then of course the ultimate final dramatic decision for this nation and its government to align itself with freedom rather than oppression, that is a momentous and you know, arguably other than the restoration of the Union itself, is, in my mind at least, the most important outcome of the American Civil War.
John Hennessy here this morning. When we come back, we'll talk about the program that will take place at the National Cemetery on Monday morning, and we'll also talk about the illumination this weekend and a number of things going on with Memorial Day 2017 in Fredericksburg. More coming up on Newstalk 1230 WFVA.
It's time. Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
John Hennessy, the chief historian with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park, here this morning as we look at Memorial Day. One of the big things around here, and the illumination at the National Cemetery on Saturday night, if you haven't seen it, you ought to, because I don't know that there's any event around here that is quite like it.
No, it has. Well, it's always been a big thing. This is our 22nd year. We've had a couple of rainouts in there. We always plan a rain date, so if it rains on Saturday, we'll plan on Sunday. And I think we've only had to not do it once or maybe twice in those 22 years. But we've been very blessed with weather. Last year we had gorgeous weather and over 9,000 people.
Yeah.
It might be the biggest single volunteer effort in the Fredericksburg region. We have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of scouts and young people who come out who assist us with that. We have the school kids who come out and place the flags. Which they're probably doing today, I think, today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
At the cemetery, which is a great thing to see. But it has become, you know, it's one of those things that it's not like a movie that if you've seen it once, you don't need to see it again. If I know, you know, my wife, every time she goes, she starts bawling. And when they play taps, we play taps on the half hour. Mm-hmm. A former member of the old guard volunteers his time for that every year and does a beautiful job, moves around the cemetery. And when amidst those 15,300 candles that are illuminated on top of the hill, one for each soldier buried there, when he plays taps, everything stops. And it is if you haven't experienced it, you should, because that's something you'll remember forever, how everybody just stops, they go quiet, and they listen. And mostly the only thing you can hear is just the shuffling of people and the occasional sniffling of people like my wife, who are numerous in there.
It is.
And I've seen it, you know, collectively I've walked up top of that hill during the illumination probably 100 times over the years, and every time it makes me stop, because it's just, when you get to the crest of the hill, it's just astounding. This visual representation of how many men, how many lives were transformed by the events in this region, how many families were touched by it, and the fact that of the 15,300 men and some women buried in that national cemetery, the names of only a couple thousand are known. More than 12,800 are unknown, and so that adds a poignancy to the whole thing. And so it is it starts at 8 o'clock on Saturday evening. I always recommend that people wait. Don't come right at 8, because it's always light. It's still light at 8.
It changes the whole.
Right.
It changes once it gets dark.
If you want to come and stay for an hour and a half or so, then come at 8 and get in the cemetery and watch it go dark, which is a very cool thing to do. But usually I advise people to come a little bit later. Notably, the most people get there right at 8, so it's busiest at 8. So coming a little later means you'll probably have fewer crowds or less dense crowds, at least, and you'll get the full effect of the illumination. A couple of years ago, it coincided with the setting of the moon.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many thousands of photographs I've seen online of the illumination of the statuary in the cemetery with the full moon setting in the west as a backdrop. Just stunning stuff.
Yeah. Now it does. You're right. If you stay and you watch and you just look across the cemetery, and it gives you, if you may have seen the cemetery during the day hundreds of times, but to see it at night and to realize just the cost to all those families.
Right. And I think being there, it's a lot of people go off by themselves. They'll go to a distant corner of the cemetery for their own thoughts. But there's a certain power, and I don't know, I am always uplifted by the fact that so many people come, that they take time out of their day to come down to Fredericksburg and just to walk through the cemetery. For many, it's a family tradition. We have folks who have, you know, have children who have been going since they were toddlers and are now grown-ups. And so that always uplifts me a lot, that so many people think it's worth their time to do. When you think about the our society today, there aren't that many people, or there aren't many things that many people think is worth doing at the same time. And so we're very gratified with how it's evolved. You know, I have to say that the illumination of the cemetery was not the idea of the National Park Service. It is dominantly, it's not even an event that we pull off per se. It is dominantly led. It was conceived and led by the Boy Scouts and now Girl Scouts in the region. And they put in a tremendous effort with lots of volunteers, close to 1,000 volunteers involved in it. And for them, it's a point of pride, and it is a rite of passage. It's become a rite of passage for almost every scout in the region now to participate in this mm-hmm. event. And so we're very proud of that and the place that it holds in the community. But, you know, we don't go for that reason. We go for our own personal reasons. And I think that whatever reason you go, you will find it gratified by being there in the dark, amidst the candles, with taps, and with your fellow Americans on Saturday night.
No, I've always thought that if you have any kind of connection, if it especially has to be meaningful, if you have some kind of a connection with the military, if you've lost a child or a parent or someone through the military, to realize that people do care. And that people are there, there's a remembrance, and that their sacrifice, whether it was here or wherever, it's people care.
Well, and you know, although we don't know the names of most of the men who lie in that cemetery, we can safely say, based on the words that they left behind, and that their fellow soldiers who survived left behind, that one of the things that they had confidence in offering up their lives for their country if they needed to be offered up, is that those who followed would remember what they had done and would remember them. And so the act of attending this ceremony, of going on Memorial Day and paying your respects wherever you choose to do that, that is the fulfillment of a bargain, if you will, an agreement, an obligation that we have. We are part of, in a distant sort of way, we are still part of that unfolding drama of war, because those who gave their lives expected nothing less than us. So that's an important gesture. And I think in many ways, Memorial Day, you know, to me has always been really the most important of the patriotic holidays. Because it is the fulfillment of an obligation that we have, and one that, you know, when we, in a nation that continues to send its young people off to war, we have to be constantly conscious of that obligation. And asking these young people today to offer up their lives, hopefully not give them, but sometimes, of course, they do, that our expression toward those soldiers and sailors and Marines and Coast Guardsmen and nurses and all the other people, all of our expression toward those who preceded them foreshadows what those who go now can expect in the future. And the fact that our nation values those who have given their lives is an important part of that equation and critically important to the health of our nation.
8 o'clock Saturday night at the National Cemetery. It's the illumination. Noon on Monday is the short program that takes place every year at the cemetery.
That's right.
And you've got a special speaker on Monday,
Rourke,
for that?
Rourke Anderson, who is retired from the United States Marine Corps in 2014. He finished his career as the chief of staff at Quantico. So he's a retired Marine Corps colonel and has deployed to Iraq, Kuwait, Bahrain, places like that, certainly Korea, Okinawa. And so He's going to share his thoughts on what that place means to him and to the soldiers of today.
Just hope that people get out and at least go to pick a program, whether it's this program or the Confederate Cemetery or the Illumination. Do something this weekend, because we've got a number, so many more programs than a lot of communities have. A lot just have something on Monday morning, and it doesn't amount to a lot, but here there are a lot of really substantial programs. John Hennessy here, the Chief Historian with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. We need to take a break. We will be back on News Talk 1230 WFVA coming up on 8:29.
Okay, listen, we got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
John Hennessy here this morning, the Chief Historian with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. As we talk about the Illumination and the program at noon on Monday at the National Cemetery, give us a little history of the cemeteries, of how did it get chosen there? I'm guessing that the federal government was looking for a place. There were a lot of bodies around here, and so they were looking for a place to bury bodies. Is that kind of how this got started?
Yeah, this is we're in the sesquicentennial of the creation of the National Cemetery.
Boy, there's always something, isn't there?
There's always something. This cemetery was, it's interesting that the National Cemetery in Fredericksburg was never dedicated. It's never been dedicated.
Huh.
If you think about it, you know, the idea emerged, of course, from the immediate post-war years. And in fact, in 1865 and 1866, there was a tremendous amount of fear stoked in the Northern press that the Union dead who lay upon the former battlefields of the South would be disrespected or desecrated by the Southerners. Now, there's no evidence that that happened other than, you know, probably teenage kids doing stupid things.
Yeah.
But there was certainly no overt effort at disrespect. But the fear of it was enough to propel the federal government into mounting a concerted effort to recover and bury properly the dead on the battlefields of the South. And so throughout the South in 1866 and 67, this effort began. Here, the federal government arrived with steamboats filled with coffins, with loads of headboards, prefabricated headboards that could be painted, and the identities mm-hmm. of the dead placed upon them. And in June of 1866, the effort began. There were burial crews. Initially, they were comprised of kind of a mixture of local men, many of them Confederate veterans, and African Americans, and other people who were willing to do the work. Over time, the burial crews were dominated by African Americans who were either hired in locally or lived locally, and the effort began. But think about what the National Cemetery does or was intended to do. It is impossible to understate the chaos that existed on these fields after the Civil War. Many of the dead had been superficially buried or not buried at all. And on the Fredericksburg battlefield, for example, that vast plain between what is today Kenmore Street and the Sunken Road, which was wide open at the time, there were two major burial trenches on that field that held close to 1,000 bodies, buried side by side. Interestingly enough, out of the nearly 1,000 men who were disinterred from that bloody plain, as we call it today, where those houses, you know, Mercer Street and Little Page Street, that neighborhood there, out of the nearly 1,000 men who were taken off that field, only two were ever identified.
Wow. But it's not surprising. It isn't surprising. Like you say, you see pictures and you just see these, you see bodies just right. strewn all over.
That's right. And so the imperatives of hygiene, if you will, that is to bury the dead quickly, won out over the imperatives of systematically identifying and remembering who they were, especially at Fredericksburg. And so ironically, of our four battlefields, the one that you would expect to have the highest percentage of identified dead, Fredericksburg, which was closest to people in town and all of that, actually has the lowest percentage of dead. So the burial crews set out. They sprawled across the region, and it would take probably a year and a half or close to 2 years for them to finish their work. Much of their work was finished within the first 5 or 6 months. So the cemetery that we know today atop Willis Hill really began to take its form. The terraces, all of that, which were an attempt to create additional space when they realized they were running low on space. All of that was part of the original creation of the cemetery. Now, the cemetery was originally proposed for that plain, the bloody plain between Kenmore Ave and the Sunken Road, where the big neighborhood now stands today. But there were some concerns about the water table there, and so eventually they moved it up onto Willis Hill. They did a condemnation of land. Charles Welford, who was a very well-known businessman at the time, owned Willis Hill at that time, and he wanted more money than the government was willing to pay. And so the government was, they confronted the task of bringing him to court to have the courts and a jury rule. But someone suggested to them that in Fredericksburg, Virginia, they were not likely to get a jury that would rule in favor of the federal government. And so they ended up paying a little bit more for that property than they otherwise would have. But it's about 12 acres and is the seed that from which the national park ultimately would grow literally more than half a decade later.
Yeah.
But it was an attempt to bring order and dignity to one of the most horrific landscapes that you can imagine. Almost 3,000 of the dead, and this will surprise most people, came out of Stafford County, where there was no major battle ever fought. But the Union encampment in Stafford County, the wounded from the Battle of Fredericksburg, the Union wounded from the Battle of Fredericksburg were mostly carried back to Stafford County. And so, in fact, there are more dead taken from Stafford County than any of our other individual battlefields themselves.
Never would have guessed that.
You never would have guessed
no.
that. But that is true. And, of course, the process of collecting and retrieving the dead was chaotic, too. It's one of those things that, we know it began, with all careful intents. Heat of the day, and the anyone who's trudged around Virginia in July knows it's pretty unpleasant stuff.
Yeah.
And trudging around Virginia in July trying to retrieve bodies is even more so. And so it turned into chaos. I mean, to give you a sense, I have a great quote from one of the soldiers who was here in June of 1865, not part of the team that reburied into the cemetery, but initially buried the dead. He said, the brush was so thick that we could not get through with the wagons to put the bones in, so we had to take sacks on our backs and run through the brush and pick up the bones and throw them into the sacks until we got them full. Then we would carry them out to a clear space where we started a graveyard. There we had coffins, and we emptied the bones out into a pile, and some of us picked up bones enough of the various kinds to make 8 men and put them into one coffin and buried them. We buried about 100 that day. We shouldn't be surprised by that. But the neat orderliness of the National Cemetery today is an antidote for the chaos that existed back then. Now, we also have gotten hints over time that, there really were sincere efforts to do this respectfully. We know, for example, in 2003 during Hurricane Isabel, we had a tree come up in the cemetery, and it pulled up the lower part of a grave of a soldier named James Clary, an Irishman from New York, Poughkeepsie, New York. And we were somewhat surprised. He had been killed, mortally wounded, in the first shots of the battle on December 11th, 1862, probably wounded on the riverside right below Chatham during the pontoon crossing down there, had been brought back to a hospital in Stafford and died there. So he was disinterred in 1866 or 1867, brought to the National Cemetery. But we were surprised to discover, the archaeologists were, that as we kind of reassembled this grave,
yeah,
that he still had his shoes on, his feet were exactly where they would be expected to be. So here clearly was a man who was, his body was handled carefully, not just once, but twice,
yeah,
during the process.
Interesting. It would have been very easy for it to be really haphazard.
That's right. But it was at times.
Yeah.
The one account that I read, which was, the earlier effort, they were just kind of throwing things together. So really, how many men are buried there? We say 15,300. We'll never really know who's represented there. We'll never really know how orderly the effort was. And, that's part of the tragedy of war. But when we, at some point today, I'll read you a quote, which really gives you a sense of why these places were so important. The fact is, in 19th century America, that most families did not have the resources to travel to Virginia to recover a body. In fact, there were businesses that popped up in Spotsylvania in 1866 and 67 before the burial crews came, that for $10 they would show you where the body was buried, and for $20 they'd recover the body and send it back to you. And there were many families who did try to recover the bodies, but the fact is that most families never were able to do that. And in fact, most of the graves in the National Cemetery have never been visited by a family member.
I was going to ask you that.
We have a description of one time when it was, and I don't know where you are in the break, but...
Go ahead.
In 1892, a woman came here. She came here in 1892 looking for the grave of her brother, a major. William Morgan was his name. He was from Maine, killed on the North Anna River. His body recovered and buried here in an identified grave, not far from where the speaker stand will be on Monday morning at our ceremony. And she came here, and she... with a tremendous sense of anticipation. She was clearly emissary for her family, because the night that she visited the grave, she wrote a letter to her sister. And in that letter, she described how she went to the cemetery office in the cemetery lodge and found someone who directed her to the grave, and how she found the grave, and she said she couldn't believe her eyes when she saw her brother's name etched in stone on the grave. Hmm. And it had been by then 28 years since he had died. And she described in vivid detail how she knelt upon the grave and just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. And the attendant from the cemetery stood next to her the whole time, watched her. There was a japonica tree, she remembered, that was had been planted next to the grave, and that there was a seed pod from the japonica tree that had fallen, that fell off while she was there onto the grave, and she took that as a sign from her brother, and she took the seed pod, and in fact the cemetery attendant cut a couple of shoots from the japonica tree so that she could take them home and grow the tree in her own garden at home. But that's why the cemeteries were created. And so while most families never got the chance to visit these graves, we are their proxies today. And the fact that we give honor to these men in this cemetery, Arlington, wherever it might be, is a powerful gesture across generations.
I told you in the sesquicentennial, the year that the lady I met who came for the program at the Bloody Angle, and she came because she had a relative who fought there, ended up dying not around here, but she wanted to be here.
Sure.
And be at the anniversary on that.
Yeah,
and
every day, and it's almost literally true, every day I get an email or a letter from someone who wants to make that pilgrimage to either find a grave or to find the spot where an ancestor fought. And I have been on probably hundreds of those with people over the years in my career. And I am always impressed by the personal connection that people feel and the pride that people feel, Northern or Southern.
Yeah.
And that personal connection to this war is what distinguishes it from most other events beyond our memories. No event in our history do Americans have such a personal connection to. No event beyond our memories do they have a more personal connection to than the American Civil War.
John Hennessy here, the chief historian with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. We'll wrap it up. We'll talk about history at sunset when we come back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
John Hennessy here, the chief historian with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park, as we talk about Memorial Day, things around here, the cemetery, and one of the staples of summer around here is History at Sunset. How many years now is this for History at Sunset?
Well, we started in 2002. We thought it was a bad idea, but that we would try. The idea that on a Friday night, people would come out and walk these places and hear these stories after a long week of work and commuting and all of that. And we very quickly discovered that our negative assumptions were wrong. And people come out and oftentimes in huge numbers. And it's been one of the most successful things that we've ever done. It's just part of the fabric of the community now.
Yeah.
And this year we're doing 8 programs rather than the usual 10, but we are doing as well 3 campfire programs that will be interspersed among them. So in fact, rather than the usual 10, there will be 11 programs, but 3 of them will be sit and listen campfire programs that give us a chance to talk about things that aren't necessarily tours, aren't necessarily site-based. So for example, on June 10th, Frank O'Reilly is going to open the campfire series and History at Sunset with a campfire program on fear and courage in battle. And then I'll do one in July on the aftermath of battle, the wounded and the dead. And then Beth Parnitza will do one in August on kind of the relationship of veterans to these places and why they mattered so much to veterans and how veterans use them. But the other 8 programs are, we start on June 16th this year. And we're actually on June 16th doing a program we've never done before. We're closing Lee Drive. And we're going to do a walk to Brayhead, Howison Hill, and Lee's Hill. That's a part of the park that we've never done a formal tour on. But the folks at Brayhead, which is a historic house that's today a bed and breakfast, have they're working with us on it so we can have access to that property. But then we'll walk up to Lee's headquarters on Lee's Hill and to Howison Hill as well. So we're excited about that. If you come to that, the trip up Lee's Hill is a little bit challenging, but we'll also have someone at the bottom for those people who can't make that climb up the hill. But so we're excited about that. We try to keep it lively and change things up and, you know, a mixture of things. We're going to do the Red Badge of Courage at Chancellorsville this year. Stephen Crane's great novel is about the Battle of Chancellorsville and very specifically about the woods near the visitor center. And so we're going to take folks back into there. We're going to do a program at Jackson Shrine this year focused on Guinea Station and the plantation there, Fairfield. Not so much on Jackson's death, although that'll be part of the story, of course, but a chance to look at that site through a different lens that we've never done before. We'll do a program, Becky Oates and I will do a program on slavery and slave places in Fredericksburg, a program we've only ever done once here. And so, and we'll close the year on August 4th for History at Sunset with a program at Salem Church. It's a, I was driving out with one of our staff members the other day, and we drove past Salem Church, which we own. We own about 2 acres there. It was conveyed to the park by the congregation several decades ago. But we just don't do enough or much at Salem Church.
I look forward to that one.
So Greg Mertz and I are going to do a program where half of it is inside the church, and then we'll switch and half go outside the church. So we're just calling it Salem Church Inside and Out. But the story of the church, the story of the battle. So I'm excited about that one. Usually every year we find something to do that we haven't done before. We've done close to 180 History at Sunset programs over the years. And I think of those 180, somewhere around 120 have been unique programs, stories that haven't been told before. So we've got a pretty big repertoire now, they're great for us. Our staff loves doing these programs, and they're the best things that we offer, I think, in the way of interpretation. And, you know, we've got a seasonal doing a program this year, Ryan Quint, and that's kind of, over the years, has become this, like, badge of honor for our seasonal employees who get to do a History at Sunset. It doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
But Ryan and Becca Jameson of our permanent staff will be doing the People and Places of the Road, the Sunken Road, and taking a different look on the Sunken Road. So we get very excited about it. In fact, we get very excited about very few other things as much as this one. So we're looking forward to this summer on that account.
It's a great. It's a great program, and you ought to check it out. And if you check one out, you'll want to go to many. You said you had a quote. Did you do the quote?
I summarized that
earlier. Oh, okay. So I didn't want to.
So we're good. But okay. One thing I want to say. You know, I don't know if he's listening or not, but David Barrett is retiring from his position at Belmont.
Yeah.
And you know, as a fellow professional, he's been just a tremendous colleague. He's kind, he's determined, he's smart. He has a way with people that's understated, which I admire very much. And he has created over there a tremendous operation that will endure long beyond his service here. But, you know, we in the Park Service, me personally, we certainly want to salute David Barrett as he heads out the door here, I think in June is his last.
So. Yeah, no, he was here, and we talked about that just a few weeks ago, just in how, and even in recent years, Belmont is back in the forefront around here.
Well, you know, we're lucky we have some really talented people working in the history business here.
Yeah.
And in fact, there aren't a lot of communities that have as many talented people as Fredericksburg does, you know, from the foundation to the George Washington Foundation, the Fredericksburg Area Museum, people like David. The galleries at Mary Washington, the Mary Washington House, and those sites as well. So we are very fortunate in this area to have what we have.
And we're fortunate to have you too. John Hennessy here, Chief Historian, Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. Again, Memorial Day weekend. Check out the website, our website, also the Park Service website, for what's going on. Penguins win tonight.
Penguins win tonight.
Thanks for listening.
And your depression continues, which is 12:30 WFVA. So I get doubly rewarded with joy and satisfaction.
That's it. See ya.
Not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.